You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Business of Practice podcast, where we focus on the business and human sides of equine veterinary medicine. In this episode, we're going to talk to Dr. Jen Brandt, AVMA Director of Member Well-Being and Inclusion Initiatives, to learn about emotional blackmail and her recommendations for those in the equine veterinary industry for how to respond to it. I'm your host, Dr. Amy Grice, business consultant and former equine practice owner. The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you in 2024 by Care Credit. Dr. Jen Brandt is a sociologist, suicidologist, and social worker specialized in the field of veterinary medicine, and currently serves as AVMA's first director of Member Well-Being and Diversity Initiatives, where she spearheads the identification, development, implementation, and coordination of education and outreach efforts at the intersection of DEI and well-being in the workplace. Dr. Brandt received her PhD in social work and her Master's of Social Work from The Ohio State University. She also holds a Bachelor of Arts in Social Work and Sociology, with a minor in Spanish from the University of Indianapolis. Prior to joining the AVMA, Dr. Brandt served in several roles at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, including Director of Individual and Organizational Development, Director of Health and Wellness, Director of Student Services. She was also the founder and coordinator of the Honoring the Bond Client Support Services Program, one of the very first university-based interdisciplinary efforts aimed at supporting all members of the veterinary healthcare team through a culturally informed, strength-based approach. Welcome, Dr. Brandt. You've got a lot of accomplishments, and I am so thrilled to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You gave a webinar several years ago, maybe it was 2 years, could have been three, for AAEP members on emotional blackmail. It was really well attended, and for me, it was really eye-opening. And so I'm really pleased to have you here with us today to talk about this important topic. And I think to start, I'd love for you to define emotional blackmail and just tell us, where do people encounter it? What does it look like? How do you recognize it?
I would say that the fancier definition maybe of emotional blackmail, it is a form of manipulation that someone uses to manage intense emotions, meet unmet needs, and maintain control over a situation. A less formal way of looking at it is it's a strategy somebody uses to get what they want in a situation where they're being refused or declined on what they want. Where do people encounter it? Anywhere, really anywhere and everywhere, where a person might be wanting something that you are not interested in giving to them. So that can happen in families, it can happen in friendships, and it certainly can happen in the workplace. In terms of what it looks like, it can be a whole range of behaviors. So it could be the silent treatment. You know, I'll kind of shut you out as a form of punishment until I get what I want. It could be guilt tripping, and a lot of times you'll know it's a guilt trip when you hear something about something like, if you really cared, if you really loved me, if you really something, then you would do what I am asking to do or asking you to do. It can look like shaming or exaggeration. So an exaggeration might be, if you don't do this thing, then a terrible thing will happen. I'm going to lose my job. You know, the world as we know it will end, you know, like some big dramatic thing is tied to if I don't get my way. And that can escalate all the way up to threats and ultimatums, you know. So if this doesn't happen, I'm going to make sure this bad thing happens to you and you're going to pay for not giving me what I wanted.
Do you see that people, you know, along those lines, like if you hold your line, like at first you're doing okay, saying, oh, I can't possibly do that, that they escalate? Is that where you see the escalation?
Yes, absolutely. I would say yes and no. So sometimes yes, particularly if this is literally the only skill the other person has, and you're saying no, then they're going to just kind of engage harder, right? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting for people who this is their default behavior. I tend to say for someone who that is their primary skill to navigate the world and get what they want, they're pretty good at it, right? And so they're really good at reading these subtle nonverbal cues that you may not even be aware that you're giving if you're the one in the situation. And so there's this uncanny ability to dial it in even better and really play on the heartstrings or whatever other emotions might be getting triggered here. That said, they're also pretty good at detecting when it is an absolute no and continuing to engage is absolutely not going to work. And so there is this capacity to shut the behavior down. But I would say it takes some energy and it takes some consistency to hold that line very firmly.
That's really good information to know, because veterinarians, I think, are really vulnerable to this because, you know, everyone gets into this not to make money, but because they love animals, they love the people that love animals, they love the animal human bond. And what you're describing, if you really loved animals, you would, like, that resonates somehow and probably in most veterinarians. You know, when you say that, we were talking about why people use emotional blackmail, like, talk to us a little bit more about the motivating factors. You mentioned a few in opening and defining, and I think it's really interesting the reasons that people sort of land on that as a strategy.
Honestly, in a nutshell, it's because it works, right?
Yeah, it does.
If the behavior didn't work, it would be extinguished. You know, if this was something I engaged in this behavior to get what I want and it never paid off, like, I'd learn another skill. So I do it because it works. And because it works, then it's this reinforcing cycle. And I don't really have to pursue many other options because I have found this strategy that is really paying off for me. And again, it's, I'm being told no to something. And maybe that no is scary to me. Maybe it's really disappointing to me. Maybe like for whatever reason, my own emotion attached to that no might be so overwhelming that basically in my brain, failure isn't an option. I have to get my way. And so I'm going to engage in that behavior. And again, I continue to do it because it works. And the more it works for me, even the better I can get at that behavior and really honing in on what someone's vulnerabilities might be, and even who in a group might be more likely to give in to my requests. Often somebody can kind of scan a room and maybe determine very early on, I'm not even going to try it with that person, but I may overhear simply based on some of the non-verbal behaviors that are being detected.
You know, I remember some clients that were that I had that were a little bit, you know, tightly wound. And when their horse had a really serious problem going on, that they didn't seem to, like, it was emotionally really super tough for them, they would sort of get a little deranged into that sort of behavior where, you know, you would be trying to explain carefully, you know, your horse has a serious condition. They are, we're going to need to do some things. And sometimes it didn't really make sense, kind of what they were saying. Perhaps they needed a sense of control over the situation, or it just freaked them out. They were afraid. Hard to know.
Yeah, I think actually that's really good insight, though. In some ways, this was a term coined elsewhere. Susan Forward wrote a book on emotional blackmail. So that's the term that's kind of understood. In some ways, I struggle with it because it's almost like there's this instant anger at the person who's engaging in the behavior, and instant assumptions about the person that maybe they're a bad person or a mean person. And the reality is most of us don't wake up and think, man, I would really like to wreak emotional havoc on folks today. And I'd really like to make folks miserable, right? Most of us are really trying to just get through the day the best way we know how with the skills we have. And I think, again, it is really important to realize that this behavior is coming from what often feels like a very desperate place. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm terrified at the outcome. If I can't afford this, I might have to euthanize my animal today. And mm-hmm. that is unbearable. And so if I can't accept that as a yes in my brain, then my brain is going to be looking at any other option. And one of them is to get you to do it differently and give me mm-hmm. different information and different options. Because the pain of that is not something that I can sit with right now. So I think it's always important when we see a human behavior, not that it's acceptable and not that we are saying it is okay, to just simply recognize that a lot of human behavior or many of these behaviors are coming from a place where the person is just trying to gain some sense of control in their life and what feels very controllable. It's not intended to harm. It does cause harm, but that's not the root motivation behind it. They don't want to see you hurt. They just don't want to be hurting either. And they're wanting different options to be able to work from.
Yeah, I think that's really important. The whole recognizing it's not intentional and that it comes up from a place probably of somebody not wanting to be hurt, needing to have more control, or, just being unable to process what's going on. And so they go somewhere else to an emotion that's more familiar or comfortable to them. You know, like I know I had a son who he did not have I still have him, but when he was younger, he didn't have much of a repertoire of emotions. Like everything was anger. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes when people get overwhelmed, this is one of the ways maybe how they try to make it feel better for themselves. And
And it's been reinforced, right? It works.
It works.
Of course, yeah. And so like the more desperate I am, why would I now search for some other tool in my toolbox when this mm-hmm. one works? Right. One of the examples you may recall from the workshop is I talk about, we've all seen the child having the meltdown at the checkout because they want the candy. The parents said no. Who knows what reaction the child will have, but we've probably seen the one where they're slamming their head into the ground. The poor parent is being judged and they know they're being judged. Mm-hmm. Everything about them is being distilled into this 30 seconds that their child is having the meltdown over the candy bar. And we ultimately see sometimes the parent takes the child out of the store. That's an option. And sometimes it's just give them the candy bar and, let me get out of the store with my a shred of dignity intact. And we think in that case, that's not a child who woke up that day and said, wow, I would really like to manipulate my parents. It's just the overwhelm that child is experiencing in facing disappointment and not having the verbal skills necessarily at that point to say, let me spell out my argument here for why I'd really like that candy bar. And for many people, in some ways, they may stay in that space, not having mm-hmm. the verbal skills, not having the ability to regulate, and going back to the skill that some have practiced and learned since they were 2 and 3. And now they're 42 and 43. Uh-huh. They're really good at the skill now, but less experience practicing other skills or having other skills not have the same payoff. So there isn't a whole lot of incentive to look mm-hmm. for other skills. And it's why we talk about when we manage this behavior, it's less about convincing that person that they need to behave differently and more about how we respond. Because if we don't reward it, it's not going to continue. And so
it extinguishes better.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you by CareCredit. Care Credit keeps equine veterinarians at the heart of care by providing horse owners with simple, budget-friendly financing options. By helping to bridge the gap between costs and care, Care Credit supports healthy financial relationships between veterinarians and their clients. Clients have a flexible way to pay over time for all types of care, and practices get paid in 2 business days. It's a payment experience everyone can feel good about.
I think one of the most memorable things in that webinar that you did for the AAEP, you were describing 3 primary categories for why people give in to emotional blackmail, and they were fear, obligation, and guilt. And then there were these 9 statements that you could sort of recognize. Have you ever had these 9 things? And I remember you, as a part of that, you were like, kind of count how many would resonate with you. And all 9, I was like, oh boy, I'm in trouble here. Would you like to share with our listeners a little bit about that? Because it was like realizing you're like, oh yeah, I got to do better here.
Yeah, we will jokingly say, where are the overachievers in the group if you can check all 9 of those boxes. So fear, obligation, and guilt, we'll often call that fog. And you'll hear the term fog used in a lot of human behavior. So it's not unique to emotional blackmail. But one of the ways you could say, well, that this was a situation when emotional blackmail was used and I did consent and I didn't want to. I often will have people kind of reflect on that and what led to a yes on your part, even when at the same time, this voice in your brain is saying, say no, you know, you're going to regret this later if you say yes. So the fear might really think anything that you might be afraid of. I'm afraid of disapproval. I'm afraid somebody will be angry at me. Angry in that they're just disappointed, or angry in that it might threaten my safety, or angry I might lose my job over it. I'm afraid the person won't like me. I'm afraid this might end the relationship. My friends will walk out on me if I set this limit. So anything kind of in the fear category. Obligation could look like, gosh, this was a person who did so much for me at some point in my life. And even though I don't want to agree to what they're asking now, I feel like I owe it to them. I'm not allowed to say no. Others really believe that they've not been empowered to say no in the workplace. Like, I don't want to agree to this, but I've not been given the authority to say no. And then you combine that with fear. And so then if I do, I'm going to get in trouble. Or that just sense, it's my duty. Of course, I'm a professional, so I have to do this. Or I'm a parent, so I have to do this, instead of, do I want to, or when I choose to do this, does this actually help the situation get better, or does it potentially contribute to the situation becoming even worse? And then guilt, guilt can play a big role in our decision making. And so I feel guilty if I say no, or any other label, it's selfish or unloving or mean or greedy or something bad about me if I say no. And I believe that saying no ultimately makes me a bad person. I might value myself as being a giver, and I've gotten a lot of praise in my life for being, that person who's there for everybody. And so that sense of loss that I might experience over saying no and not getting that praise, and then interpreting that as then I must not have any value. So when you look behind those reasons where then I might say yes, when I really want to say no, those are pretty potent, particularly when they're living all in our head and becoming magnified and true, because we're not really having a chance to say, wait a minute, does this really, like if I say no to loaning somebody $500 in cash right now, does that really make me an awful person? But these situations are so intense, we don't really have time in that moment to really say, wait a minute, let me challenge this for just a minute before I answer yes or no to the request.
So I bet that sort of giving yourself a little time or thinking more about it must be kind of an effective way. What are the effective ways to respond? I mean, I know like probably stopping your brain from awfulizing all the bad things that can happen would be step number one.
Yeah, I will say in terms of ways to respond, I'm always careful to say these might be ways that are good for you. It doesn't necessarily curb the behavior that's happening. It may or may not, but this is more where, like, at the end of the day, you can look in the mirror and say, okay, I lived in alignment with my values today. One step is just to label it when it's happening. By the way, not out loud. We're not saying to the person, hey, you know, you're engaging in this manipulative behavior and I attended a workshop on it. But just have a name for it, because otherwise the internal angst and turmoil that we are experiencing feels so big that when we can put a label on it, like, oh yeah, okay, somebody's needing something that I'm not giving and they're uncomfortable about it. They're creating some discomfort in me. Again, that's kind of a quick conversation you have, but just to get a little distance from it can help. Two, much easier said than done, but trying to keep your own reactivity low, or at least don't demonstrate it, because in some ways, if you start becoming very emotional and reactive and your voice starts raising, what it tells the other person is, hang
it's
in
working.
There. Yes, this is working. So even if you're feeling all of that on the inside, if you can, you know, kind of take a deep breath and not necessarily express all of that. Remember that at the end of the day, you get to choose. Right? You get to say yes or no. Yes, whatever choice you make likely comes with consequences. But often we tend to focus on the consequence of saying yes or no, and not really focusing on the other thing. Like when I give in, wow, you know, that situation has dissipated. But no, it hasn't. Now it's been rewarded. Now you have to live with the fallout. Now you're going to be resentful of that choice. Like that came with a whole host of consequences as well. When you say no, say it and mean it and look like you mean it. So this is a real, like an assertive communication. You know, you're making eye contact if you're in person and it's a clear no. It's not like a no that sounds like a maybe. It's no explanation or justification, right? Because if somebody really wants what they want, there's almost nothing you can say that they're going to be like, oh, sure. Wow. Great point made. You're right. I won't ask anymore. Like the more words you give, the more they can point counterpoint you. So a simple no with a period on the end is really ideal. Know the situations where you can walk away so that you're limiting exposure. Like I'm not going to engage in this conversation anymore. And then one of my favorites is really the buying time, which is like a no for now. Like sometimes the emotion is so intense, the person is really wanting you to answer now, right? Because they've got the reins on the situation right now. And you may feel so overwhelmed, you don't even know really how you want to answer. You just want the situation to stop. So one thing that you can practice out loud several times so that it is in your back pocket ready to go is, I need some time to think about this and I will follow up with you on Friday or Thursday or whatever. And then it is your job to follow up. But just buying yourself some time so that you can get out of that fog and process, okay, what are the implications if I say yes? What are they, you know, if I say no? Do I have support for saying no? But you can do that now with the safety of time. And it does take control. Like the person wanted the answer right now. So you've already thwarted that. You already have gained some control back. What wouldn't be uncommon is the person to say, no, I need the answer now. And then you can say, well, I told you I needed time to think about it. If you're needing the answer now, however, then it's no. So you've kept control of it. And often you'll hear somebody backpedal and then they'll say, oh, well, you said you could get back to me Thursday. Yes, Thursday. And then you can still follow up then with a no, I'd say. Or if you're changing your mind to a yes, be really clear in your own brain what motivates you to do that. So that is something that you can stand by, you know, that you are at peace with that decision, not that you feel like you had to say yes because you had no other option that came to mind.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, although no is a complete sentence, it feels rude. And so I think that taking the time, I love like giving yourself that little bit of space to get away from reacting so you can respond instead.
And practicing no in low stakes. It's not as common now in the post-pandemic era, but you know, before then, like in the days when they were just squirting perfume at you at the mall, like it was okay to say no thank you, and you don't have to go into a long-winded allergy about your or explanation about your allergy, right, and how it give you a headache. Like nobody needs that much information. Just no and keep moving. When a salesperson approaches you and you're not interested in speaking, it's okay. No, thank you. And keep moving. It doesn't have to be rude or aggressive. Mm-hmm. Again, and you're not overly obligated to give any information. I didn't ask for you to approach me. I didn't ask for this invitation. It's a no, period. But practicing when it's low stakes or when you're being offered a snack at Sam's Club or Costco, just practicing saying no when the stakes are so low, because otherwise it's going to be very hard to pull on that when the stakes are really high for us. So I've even had situations where I've coached folks to, you know, have that friend who loves you and wants you to get better at this skill. And they call and ask you to come to the movies, like just practice saying no. Even when you when the friend knows it's a practice situation and no stakes, right? It's perfectly okay. I've had people say like the discomfort of that, it had them almost crawling out of their skin. Like, good. One, that is teaching you that this is a skill that it will you will need to practice because it's not really comfortable. And it's okay. Like, sit with that sense of feeling like you're crawling out of your skin and realize that in 30 seconds that starts to alleviate, or maybe the next day and you got through it and the friendship is still intact, you're okay. And then practice it again in a low stakes environment so that we do have it when, you know, we really do need it. Like sometimes we really do need to hold our ground, even when the other person is going to be very upset about that response. It's still really important to say no.
That's such excellent advice, especially the learning to be uncomfortable and getting comfortable with uncomfortable feelings and knowing you're not going to feel that way forever.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I remind people that the saying yes when you didn't want to is also uncomfortable. The resentment that we feel, the anger, we'll talk about it with 10 other people. Like, I can't believe they asked me this. And, you know, we don't really talk about, I can't believe I said yes when they asked me what I really wanted to say no. That's uncomfortable too. It's just, it's become so habitual to us that it doesn't necessarily register in the same way that the discomfort of I said no. Ugh. And then I felt like I was crawling out of my skin. And I've had people even say like my brain went to wild places, like I had so catastrophized it. And I've had clients I've asked to journal about that or talk about it. And they'll say now that they can look at where their brain was going, like no wonder there was the discomfort. But, you know, a no at, you know, a friend wanted to go to the movies and I said no. And the discomfort, some will say, I literally had the world ending like five thoughts later, right? I said no to this. I'm going to lose all my friends and then I'm going to end up homeless and I'm going to die on the streets and no, like
alone.
And usually when we hear somebody saying that out loud, we kind of laugh in recognition because we've all done that. But to get it out loud and realize, oh, that's what's happening. Okay. Yeah. I don't need to catastrophize saying no to that level because chances are the earth will still continue to spin on its axis. And if it doesn't, it's not really related to the fact that I said going to the movies. But yeah, like it is a skill that we need to practice and think about the person who goes to this skill all the time. They certainly have had a lifetime to perfect it. So, give us a little break at getting some more experience in at deflecting it and helping extinguish the behavior.
Right. So as we close, is there any other advice or anything that you would want to share with our listeners in closing?
I'll emphasize again that emotional blackmail is a dance, so it only works if there's a partner, right? So make the decision, I'm not going to partner in this anymore. And the other thing I would say specific to work teams is it's not uncommon for us to see this behavior play out in the workplace. Let's say a client might make a demand of a person on the team. The person on the team does say no. The client didn't get what they wanted, and so they escalate, I want to speak to the person in charge. And then the person in charge comes out and gives a yes. Anytime I give that example, everybody's lived it. They're like, I have not met anybody who's like, wow, I've never seen that happen before.
Right.
Right. And what I'll often then hear are also teams talk about a concern about turnover, and then they'll attribute it to something else. But when you do an exit interview, it's like, my own team didn't have my back in these situations. You know, I was doing my job. I set the boundary and I wasn't even allowed to. That got undermined. And now people don't respect me and I can't count on my team. Like, that is not a good feeling to work with. So I always encourage teams, like, have these conversations as a team. Realize that there may be vulnerabilities for this behavior, maybe when it comes to the bill or other policies and procedures that we have in place. We can even role play. We know what the words are that will be said. We even know who might be targeted on this team that we say those words to. So be very clear that it's as a team, we are saying no to this behavior, that whoever says no will be supported, that the next person called in will also say no. And the next person that gets called in will also say no, so that we extinguish that behavior and don't, you know, subject the team to being ongoingly vulnerable to this. And I think that as a team is an incredibly important conversation to have and be really clear on. Not only is everybody empowered to say no, but really there's almost a team responsibility for psychological safety to say no.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent point. Really, really important. And what a wonderful thing to end with, because, gosh, you hit the nail on the head. Nobody's going to say, oh, I never knew that happened, because everybody's experienced it. And it does make you feel like you don't matter.
Yeah.
So excellent, excellent advice for teams. Terrific. I am so glad that you were able to join us today. Thank you so much, Dr. Brandt. And thank you all for listening to the Business of Practice podcast. And a great big thanks to our sponsor, Care Credit. And to all my listeners out there, be brave, embrace change,